AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
It's The Wonky Show. Net migration is up. The government is restricting student immigration. But will the proposals be enough? Plus, rental reform is causing controversy and regulation is getting more expensive. It's all coming up.
Yeah, and I think you'll remember, I think, that there were certain individuals, officials who'd never met each other, who were sort of like first time in the round table. Maybe they'd had been emailing each other, but they'd actually physically had the chance to sort of trade these discussions. And the other thing was also the sort of passing the buck. You know, we couldn't get around that situation. I think sometimes the department thinks.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Associate Editor Jim Dickinson, and joining me to roll in the weeds of HE policy this week, as usual, three Titanic guests. In Kingston, Chris Skidmore is Net Zero Chair and MP for Kingswood. Chris, your highlight of the week, please.
I think sort of the decision of the Home Office to sort of row back on their initial proposals was definitely, from an HE perspective, I think, good news. So I know we'll be talking about that, but I think that was a highlight for me.
Yes, excellent. We will get to that. Just north of Watford, Andy Westwood is Professor of Government Practice at the University of Manchester. Andy, your highlight of the week, please.
Morning all. Well, my highlight, I was at a book launch last night at the Resolution Foundation. It's quite nerdy, this highlight, but I'm going to go with it. And the book launch was Power and Progress by Darren Acemoglu, and the launch included Diane Coyle. So basically two of my absolute favourite economists in the same room, and I came away with a signed book.
Wow, excellent.
Which we'll I shall now that. Read sort of in
link,
about 3 years'
link
time.
Link to that in the show notes.
Yeah.
In Cromer this week, Debbie McVitie is editor at Wonky. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
I've been struggling to think of one this week because it's been quite an intense week so far. So I'm going to say our team meeting, where we get together once every 6 weeks or so to chew over the fat of our education policy behind closed doors and just generally catch up with what everyone's been up to, and that was lovely.
Yes, jolly good time was had by all. So yes, we start this week with international students. Net migration is up and it's dependents that are down, Andy.
It is. Well, it's as Chris has already sort of said on this, it's been there's been quite a long run up to this story. In many cases, sort of, you know, several years. But we're expecting the migration figures at some point this week, or any minute now, in fact. And the expectation is that they're going to be kind of quite high, and a pretty significant increase on last year. So, you know, we've got the kind of broader politics of what does that mean? What does that mean for a government that in various forms has been keen to control these numbers? What does that mean for the opposition? Keir Starmer obviously led on kind of the immigration figures yesterday at PMQs, and really sort of twinned it with an accusation that the high numbers are related to the government's failure to kind of manage the domestic economy, essentially. And in that, you have this sort of fairly familiar debate about international students and what you can do, if you should wish, to control these numbers. And as Chris said in his highlight, if Suella Braverman was left to her own devices, the kinds of things that she was talking about at the National Conservative meeting last week, then, you know, we could probably expect to see some pretty drastic curbs on the numbers of students or the types of institutions or courses that they might attend. But after some pushback from not least from Rishi Sunak, Jeremy Hunt, and Gillian Keegan, what we've ended up with is a restriction restriction on the number of dependents that international students can bring to the UK, particularly for postgraduate taught courses. Now, the background to this is quite interesting because, as you've pointed out, Jim, you know, those numbers have been rising pretty significantly in recent years. And the overall kind of number of visas granted to dependents last year were over 130,000, which, according to the government's data, is nearly nine times the number in 2019. So we've seen pretty significant growth in the number of dependents that are accompanying international students. And we've seen particular growth from particular countries and particular markets. So, you know, there is something going on there. And it's become the particular place where government has, well, where the Home Office have decided they can act. And that the other parts of government think is acceptable. But I think you know, the broader politics of this is probably the most important thing. I mean, I know that in higher education, universities will and have kind of returned to lots of those now well rehearsed defences about the importance of international students, and you know, and it's been good to hear lots of those arguments again. But the broader politics of immigration is a lightning rod for this government. And so, you know, alongside small boats, anchoring ships off Dorset and the kind of, you know, the symbolic kind of measures that are being taken, you know, we have to have this sort of semi-manufactured row about international students and a set of measures which, you know, if they are introduced, won't be until early 2024, so probably just after the next election. So there's a kind of, I think for the government, the most important thing here is having a story of action in a week where the numbers are going to go very, very high, rather than the specific details. You know, they need to be seen to be doing things. And I think this is the context that this particular crackdown really sits in.
Let's get to the politics. Chris, you know, part of the problem I suspect here is that on the one hand, the manifesto, you know, had another of the kind of promises to get numbers down. And the Home Office's kind of, you know, impact assessment on the graduate route was much more modest than it's turned out in terms of numbers. So given that numbers are massively bigger than where everyone expected them to be, you know, the kind of success has been so successful, that now comes into sharp conflict with that manifesto commitment, doesn't it?
Well, I think in respect to the graduate route, that, you know, it was obviously a part of the manifesto commitment also, that what we've seen, and we've just published, I chair an International Higher Education Commission that was set up directly to try and sort of counter what we saw the government beginning to articulate last summer. So, as has been mentioned, this has been a long time coming. And if there weren't other things going on with people messing up decisions or over speeding fines, then this would be seen as a humiliating climb down on that rhetoric that was being put out, you know, by the Home Office last summer, I think was when it began. And actually, you know, I'm really keen to do is to sort of analyze, you know, who are these international students? I mean, they shouldn't be in the migration figures anywhere. There are other countries that don't include them. And that was UKIP policy back in 2014 to remove international students from net migration figures. We do well to potentially copy only once this particular UKIP policy. But actually, what we've seen, and what the International Higher Education Commission published an interim report this week also, is that actually the growth in international students is predominantly the growth in one-year master's courses. And those are obviously leading to a post-study work visa of up to potentially sort of 3 years as well. And that's something that is cannibalizing the full degree route. We've actually seen international student full degrees, the three-year courses, fall by 16,000 students. We've seen PhDs fall by 1,500 students. It's actually in the one-year master's that we've seen this sort of turbocharging sort of takeoff. And that's not sustainable for universities. It's bringing in far less income. That's not the most important thing they should be focusing on, but it's still the same numbers for the less resource overall.
Debbie, what do you think is going to happen next here in terms of demand or how universities might respond? I mean, presumably we're about to get a big bulge in demand around September?
I mean, it's very hard to know, I think. And this is part of the problem. And I think if you look at some of the language that the Prime Minister used writing in the Telegraph, for example, there does seem to be this sense that demand is stable and predictable and a given. And that students kind of faced with a change in the environment for a UK qualification won't simply decide to go elsewhere, which of course is very much, you know, within their capability if they want to go to the US or Canada or Australia or one of the other countries that is, would be very pleased to welcome them. So I think there is, because it's partly about you know the actual change in demand. It's partly about the perception of the environment that awaits students. Even if you know whether or not they have dependents, there will be some students who would have wanted to bring dependents and now won't be able to, and will presumably make kind of decisions on that basis. And then there will be the ways that universities perhaps pivot their recruitment tactics in light of. You know, the extent to which they understand the number of students that they have that are bringing dependents, which is actually not something that universities, I think, always have a very good grip on, because this is not something that has, you know, historically been data that universities have needed to collect. So I think the overall consequence is that certainly I think there'll be a rush to fill boots in the year ahead, which will only kind of probably, you know, exacerbate the overall problem, which is that there's that lack of sort of stability of policy in this area means that universities are kind of forced into kind of tactical sort of responses rather than sustainable long-term planning with the sort of numbers that we then see.
I just say I agree entirely with Debbie. I also agree with Chris's point about taking them out of the figures and kind of avoiding these debates. But I think you know, Debbie, you've completely hit the nail on the head here. I mean, what we've seen is big expansion of master's provision. I teach a master's program.
My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts. So I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
Graham, in Manchester, but a big, big expansion of numbers, both for domestic students and obviously international students. And it's become a kind of major fill your boots moment for universities for lots of different reasons. But, you know, what we don't do is talk about all of those things. So in a sense, Keir Starmer was quite smart, I think, to sort of say, well, actually, you know, how does this relate to the kind of economy that we need and the role of universities and colleges, for that matter, to help kind of build that economy, whether it's through things like the apprenticeship levy or undergraduate or master's students. But what we've got are kind of short-term kind of knee-jerk strategy to fill gaps, to fill holes, rather than kind of take a long-term view about kind of what are we trying to do here? You know, what do we really want to offer the world? What do we really want to offer the UK in terms of skills that it can use in its attempts to kind of boost its own productivity, which has been obviously a kind of big problem for the last 10, 15 years. And there's a complete absence of that. There's a complete absence of that in the debate about international students. There's a complete absence of that, I'm afraid, in universities' own discussions about the kind of provision that they're putting on in relation either to the economy as a whole or to kind of, you know, local and regional economies as they evolve. So I think there are some huge kind of vacuums around this policy, which I think in terms of some of the bigger headlines for the country, you know, what kind of economy are we trying to build? What kind of living standards are we trying to, trying to improve? What kind of public services are we trying to kind of build alongside those things? You know, that we just don't talk about at all. And I think that's the most frustrating thing.
Chris, on this issue of planning, obviously, you know, the original international education strategy had the target that it had over 10 years. And one of the things that Rishi Sunak regularly says is, well, you appear to have hit the target disproportionately early. That would suggest that the level of planning that you need to do when you have huge increases hasn't necessarily gone in. And I guess on one level or another, your new commission is trying to fill some of those gaps in, albeit a bit belatedly.
Yeah, I think sort of ensuring that universities have this sort of social license to practice in their communities when it comes to international education and student provision is exactly why the commission is there. I don't want some kind of boom and bust where universities are accused of over recruiting, those toxic narratives of bums on seats, and actually, we can demonstrate a stable, continuous pathway, which is in everyone's interest, and particularly for certain universities that are located in areas where the housing provision isn't sufficient. It's not sustainable for the students themselves, and I'm extremely worried about potentially for those international students coming to the UK that they're sold a dream, and then the reality is they're having to sort of commute 30 miles into campus because there's simply not the accommodation for them. So place planning is as important as much as strategically planning. I think the other challenge we've got is the country by country planning. When I was universities minister, I remember giving speeches saying we've got to reduce our dependence on one particular country without actually specifically naming what that country was, although we sort of it was very much an elephant in the room. But now that's happened. Actually, I think you'll see that a reduction in the number of Chinese international students has occurred. The challenge has been the recruitment's taken place from other African countries, namely, and if we're going to name them, Nigeria, where actually some of those students have already had children by the time they come to look to study. So the counter challenge is that you can begin to strategically change direction like an oil tanker. It takes time, but at the same time we should have thought through if we were going to be recruiting from elsewhere, what are the consequences of that? And part of that was that dependence challenge.
Debbie, I guess it's genuinely difficult to do some of that planning when certainly I could put a bet on that in 6 months' time we get the next set of net migration figures, this time for summer to summer. They won't have gone down. Sunak might be on the ropes in terms of polls. It's really hard to do long-term planning here, isn't it?
It is. And Andy's right to sort of talk about the politics of this any party leader is always going to be having to kind of triangulate between, looking to the next election, the kind of various sort of more extreme parts of the party trying to outflank them on different issues. And as a consequence, we don't get a very kind of mature conversation, about some of this stuff. But I think, one of the areas though, where I think I hope the conversation kind of evolves a bit further, because it hasn't really come out so much in the media coverage yet, is, in Braverman's written statement, part of the package of measures was looking at agents and the use of agents and where agents are perhaps doing some of that selling the dream in a way that is perhaps not quite accurate. And I'm genuinely curious as to whether there's a plan there and what the plan is, because I think that seems to be an area where it's sort of been long understood that there probably needs to be a bit more of an in-depth conversation going on. I don't know if that would make an immediate change before next summer. I highly doubt it, because I think that's probably part of a long-term thing as well. But that does seem to be an area where there could be some useful efforts going in that would help to kind of cool things down a little bit.
Andy, as you noted, Keir Starmer went in kind of hard on, they've lost control of immigration at PMQs this week. If there was a Labour government after the next election, what might happen there?
Well, I think, that's, as in many areas of higher education, that's quite tricky to tell. I think if you take that broader view, and as we're already discussing here, whether it's sensible to be dependent on particular markets. There's a big conversation about what resilience looks like economically. Rachel Reeves did a big speech in Washington yesterday, setting out Labour's kind of economic vision. And it's very much, this is an area obviously Chris is very familiar with. It's very much a kind of vision that looks and feels intentionally like Bidenomics. Rachel Reeves calls it secure-onomics. So there's a phrase that's going to fly onto leaflets around the country. But the principles are all relevant. You know, it's about kind of growing a domestic economy, particularly in certain sectors. The government released its semiconductor strategy this week. So you know, this is something actually where the Conservatives and Labour are kind of feeling around some of the same issues, trying to answer the question about what the relationship with China looks like, what it means for industrial strategy, regional strategy in the domestic economy, to build that resilience or to work with allies as opposed to those that might not share our values. And this is where kind of all the stuff around the Inflation Reduction Act and Chips and Science Act really becomes quite interesting in the US. And what Labour are trying to do, I think, is set out that context. And for universities, I think the question is, well, where do universities fit in that world? And it's from there that you get to the questions about relationships with particular countries, about international students, about particular subjects, particular sectors. And I think universities would be wise to kind of think, well, okay, this is a more active government. This is a government that will probably want universities, whether it's in R&D or teaching or in terms of particular sectors and places, to do particular things. And that's probably more active things than universities are used to doing. And so I think, you know, again, we have to start with that bigger picture. And I think for Labour, we're beginning to see what that bigger picture looks like economically. And the kind of higher education plans will essentially come downstream from that. But we'll have to fit everything that we want from government kind of into that same dialogue, whether it's increased funding or kind of, you know, particular support for research or civic activity. You know, we need to see our strategies, our future plans through those particular kind of types of lenses too, I think.
Well, I think, you know, we've been talking about international education and student mobility. You know, none of these challenges, these global challenges, you know, whether this is around building out a green future industry, are going to be solved without having that mobility of labour and, you know, mobility of highly trained engineers and a number of different disciplines that will be needed. So, you know, we can focus on the Bidenomics and the investment, but actually, it's interesting, obviously, the government had to carve out for PhD students, and rightly so, but we've sort of lost that Dominic Cummings narrative of the global talent visa and bringing sort of international students here as being a good thing. And I was quite struck, actually, by Starmer's comments yesterday, because he sort of went in hard on the whatever the skilled visa labor route is, but actually when you sort of break down the jobs that have been coming through in terms of the descriptions on that that visa route, you know, they're all jobs that we need. They're nurses, they're care workers, but they're also some of the scientists and engineers that we're going to need to deliver on net zero. So, you know, we've got to have an honest conversation on both both political parties about the reality of why, you know, immigration and skilled immigration is a good thing if we want to actually deliver on a green industrial revolution.
Great. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi. My name's Matt Coldry and I'm a senior lecturer in sports coaching at Hartbury University. So the idea for my article on the Wonky blog stems from my own experiences of having ADHD and working as a lecturer. So since my diagnosis as an adult, I've reflected in depth on how my ADHD does cause me to find some aspects of my role quite challenging, but also how it does provide me with some unique strengths as well. The article relates to a wider project that I've set up called the Neurodivergent Network, and this project aims to raise awareness about what neurodiversity is and how it can affect people, as well as aiming to create a more inclusive working and studying environment as well for neurodivergent people. There's still quite a lot of misunderstanding when it comes to neurodiversity. So it's really important to highlight how these conditions can affect individuals both positively and negatively in their work and study. So this article specifically covers ideas related to ADHD and working with ADHD. And It aims to explain how, with a proper understanding of what ADHD is and how it influences a person, we can create environments that not only unlock the potential of neurodiverse employees, but also help to harness some of those super strengths that people with ADHD possess within them as well.
Now, next up, barely a week since the Renters Reform Bill was published, and we have a U-turn, Debbie.
That's right. So the Renters Reform Bill was introduced in Parliament last week by Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove. For our purposes, there are two key provisions in that bill that are relevant to the student rental market. And those were that there would be students, or you know, all tenants would be able to get to leave their tenancies with 2 months' notice. And that is in the context of the student rental market, where landlords had been issuing fixed term tenancies of 12 months to students, that would mean that students would essentially be able to depart their tenancies early. The other was the overall abolition of fixed term tenancies. So actually it wouldn't be possible for if a student had stayed in their tenancy for 12 months, that they would then be able to stay on. For various reasons, landlords have been lobbying against that. Particularly because it's quite advantageous to landlords to be able to lock students into annual contracts, and then of course be able to kind of move on to another group of students and thus thus put up the rent. And the risk that was threatened was that landlords might leave the sector altogether if the system couldn't be made to work for them. So what's happening now is that Michael Gove is considering introducing an amendment that would exempt off-street student accommodation from some of those provisions. So it would be possible to allow a yearly let or a 12-month tenancy in student property specifically.
Yes, Chris, I guess the danger here is that in an effort to improve rights for student tenants, that we see a collapse in supply. And supply feels pretty tight around the country right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think there's a number of, and policy is always around understanding where's the Venn diagram of a succession of different policies sort of hitting landlords in a way that means that some of them just sell up and decides enough's enough. So in a way, for me, it points to, where's the future direction of policy? Does it come from the centre? We talked about place planning earlier. Surely there must be a greater opportunity for effectively devolved responsibilities around trying to identify what are the pressures, what's the reality, working obviously through national frameworks and guidelines. But we don't get that sort of sense of this sort of levelling up opportunity, I guess you might want to call it, around thinking about accommodation provision. It's just not sort of something that's part of the equation. And as you say, it's all rights-based, but with rights comes reality, the consequences in reality.
Yeah. I mean, part of this, Andy, is, this is something you talk about a lot. You've already talked about today on the show, which is, this isn't really a government that's into planning, is it?
Well, no, and there are ideological reasons for that. It's a government that's a party that is traditionally not keen to be that active and to plan and to do those things. But in housing, we know that a government has to be active if you look at the supply of housing across the piece. And we also know that the demand for housing is very uneven across the country, and that's because the economy is very uneven. And we know that the demand for student housing is very uneven and has become more uneven because of, and you know more about this than just about anybody on the planet, because of kind of the way that sort of university recruitment has evolved over the last sort of few years, but with kind of COVID, with a kind of great expansion of particular types of universities, you've now got kind of huge pressure. And you just look at some of the anecdotal kind of stories of the kinds of rents that students are going to pay for sort of 12 months in the private sector next year in places like Manchester or Leeds or Newcastle or Birmingham, and they are eye-watering because, of course, when you can, you know, if you've got those constraints, the market's going to exploit that kind of scarcity. And so I think, I mean, I think Chris is right. There's a, you know, housing has been a big part of the devolution conversation that Michael Gove is obviously having with mayors and with combined authorities that are sort of coming down the track. And I think that's an entirely good thing. So I think, you know, I do think you can take some of these decisions closer to the places where the pressures are really felt, but it doesn't get you away from the kind of key problem, which is that, you know, we don't, whether that's the kind of government's fault or the private sector's fault, and it's both, we don't build enough houses, and we've got an incredibly uneven economy and sort of student market that tends to make these things worse in lots of particular places. Mm.
Debbie, I mean, even if we set aside this stuff about, you know, the complexities of being able to give 2 months' notice or the fixed-term tenancy thing, given that, you know, the government is saying that about 20% of off-street private rented sector houses don't meet the kind of minimum decent home standard, presumably any rental reform in that tips in it towards renters is going to see some cowboys leave the market. And whatever happens here, that we are due for a further tightening of supply, aren't we? Or is that scaremongering, do you think?
I think it's one of those things you can make some quite good universal statements on, which, you know, it's good if renters are empowered in relation to landlords, because there is an imbalance there, particularly I think in the student market, where, you know, renter, you know, as you know, they're sort of new to renting and therefore don't necessarily know what their rights are. It is good if the homes available are of an appropriate standard and livable, and we know that both these things are problems, and this is why this bill is needed. This is what Michael Gove, you know, to give him every credit, is sort of setting out to deal with. I think the problem is that you can't guarantee that it's going to be the cowboys that leave the market. Because I think, you know, one of the sort of nature of the system is that people who get around regulations are, you know, are quite good at doing that. And the fear, I suppose, is that it's not the people who are essentially kind of taking advantage of the system, that, you know, that they would remain in the system, and that people who are just trying to, you know, make an honest buck are the ones that get driven out. I've genuinely no idea if that's scaremongering or not. I mean, that's the argument, that's the risk. My feeling, though, is that one of the kind of problems with this bill is that because it is very hard to distinguish between private renters, you know, who have homes, you know, jobs and families and who are kind of, you know, and for whom this is their kind of forever, you know, this is their sort of semi-permanent home, and students. It's hard to make that differentiation, and the bill sort of is sort of note where there are differences between those two groups. The bill's trying to kind of introduce exemptions or try and kind of manage that. I do wonder whether actually there just needs to be really, you know, some meaningful thought needs to be given to the specifics of the student market and articulating the specific nature of that market. Because I think Andy's right to say that, you know, the government, you know, may need to intervene in housing, but when it comes to a sort of a peripatetic community like students, that has very kind of distinctive features, and introducing some regulatory activity that is tailored to that particular context, I think would probably be quite sensible, rather than trying to kind of cherry pick exemptions and try and kind of make it work as one whole system.
Chris, on that, you'll recall that when you were universities minister, you got a round table going where there were some officials from DfE and some officials from, I think, you know, what must have been called communities at the time. And, you know, I was in that room and I thought that was very interesting, because generally my perception has always been that DfE points at, you know, communities or levelling up or whatever and goes, that's their problem. And that department points at DfE and says, yeah, but you're bringing the students. I mean, do you think there is a problem with a focus on student accommodation in the kind of, you know, the mechanisms of the state?
Yeah, and I think you'll remember, I think, that there were certain individuals, officials who'd never met each other, who were sort of like first time in the round table. Maybe they'd had been emailing each other, but they actually physically had the chance to sort of trade these discussions. And the other thing was also the sort of passing the buck. You know, if we can get around that situation, I think sometimes the department thinks that, you know, it's convenient for universities to have autonomy when, you know, the government doesn't want it to be their problem. And obviously in other areas, you know, the government's very keen to sort of crack down on that autonomy when it doesn't suit them. But housing is definitely one where the government feels sort of, you know, universities should show their autonomy and keep government out of the way. But also there's an assumption, I think, from a physicality perspective, I think, of when, you know, ministers go to universities and go on campus and they're given these tours, you see the shiny new buildings, you know, put up by Unite or UPP, and yeah, you know, that's great, but sort of it lends to an assumption that it's all fine when you know it's not, and the reality is sort of hidden away. But understanding that, you know, student accommodation providers aren't going to be able to solve this challenge by themselves, that ministers do need to step up and cover that huge issue around the private rented sector and some of the, you know, the grotty standard of living that students have put up with for too long. I know there was, obviously we had Grenfell, but then there was that other separate occasion which has been forgotten about now. I think it was in Manchester where we had the fire that took place also in student. That was it, Bolton, yeah. And it pointed also to a point when, again, for lack of place planning decisions, I think it was at Bristol, they were sort of sending students over to Newport to live. And it struck me that, you know, again, there hadn't been that opportunity to convene in the past. And we think we've gone backwards in terms of, I don't think we've had that convening opportunity since. And we do really need to think about how to bring, you know, not only departments together, but those officials to understand that the mirage of thinking we can just leave it to the student accommodation sector, to the larger providers in the private sector, is not possible.
And that's, you know, that's also true. It takes us back to the international students dimension, because most of the investors and the private sector developers who are either acting on their own or in concert with universities are essentially want to go after the international market. And so the people that do want to build in city centres, in big student cities, are chasing the market that kind of, you know, in one form or another, some bits of government would like to restrict. So, you know, in economics, you'd call this a coordination problem.
Good. Now, finally this week, the Office for Students is putting its prices up, Chris.
I don't know what sort of, you know, whether that's going to be seen as a wise decision from a reputational perspective. But I guess the challenge is again, you know, if you've sort of been to the Office for Students offices down in Bristol, it's sort of like, it looks like it's run on a shoestring. There's that image and reality, I think, between having set up a regulator and then expecting it to sort of just like run like a Rolls-Royce operation from scratch. When I think, you know, the OFS would never admit this, but, you know, they've had this sort of journey of having been established and then suddenly everything's been placed on them. They went through that difficult phase of obviously doing the registration processes, which took up, you know, an enormous amount of their time. And, you know, they've not got the resource to potentially, you know, deliver on what they're being asked.
Yes, Debbie. I mean, you know, I mean, it's almost 20%, isn't it? The increase. Is it? Do you think it's that OFS is being asked to do too much, or that it hasn't got the money to do the things that quite rightly it should be doing?
Well, I mean, it's taking on new things, and this is part of the context here, because some of these things involve, you know, the duties around the Free Speech Act, the fact that it's going to take on the designated quality body role, because QAA is no longer doing that for England, and then there's all kinds of sort of expectations around preparation for the lifelong learning entitlement. And I mean, whatever you may think about free speech or the kind of machinations around quality, I don't think there's any other organisation that could be doing, that could be, you know, they need, these things need to be done. And I'm not sure that there's anyone other than OFS that could do them. So, I think it is fair to say that OFS is in a bit of a tricky situation, because it doesn't have the kind of relationship with the sector where the sector is going to be understanding, particularly in the context of some of the financial challenges the sector is facing, about these fees. But on the other hand, we really don't want the regulator to be doing these things badly, and in an under-resourced way. I think the model of subscription is, a pretty challenging one. And I think it perhaps is a good moment to reflect on what that compact is actually in terms of what the sector can expect back from OFS, in terms of accountability, you know, in relation to these fees, I think it might be time to kind of have another look at that and think about that relationship.
Andy, obviously there's that Lords Committee that has been looking at OFS, and I get a sense in light of that, amidst that, as the press would say, that there's a kind of a new level of bravery around the sector in terms of taking a pot shot at OFS. But I keep looking at all of its functions and thinking, which of these would you drop? I mean, you know, they're all actually really quite important from a student interest perspective, aren't they?
Yeah, well, of course they are. I mean, I think, firstly, obviously 20% in the current climate is a bit crazy, and it's a little bit tin-eared of the OFS to kind of go down this route, I think. But, you know, they've been accused of that before in other areas. I mean, I think broadly, you know, you've got two problems here. I mean, governments are always going to ask the OFS to do more. This government, it happens to be free speech and kind of, you know, the quality stuff. And as we talked about in the kind of broader economic approach, you know, Labour will ask for more levers over what higher education does, and that will fall to the OFS. So governments of whatever stripe are going to want a body to do more. But I think the second thing is that it just shows that the OFS was, as a regulator, and it'd be interesting to see whether the Lords Inquiry gets into this detail, was that, in my view, it was always too narrow a model. You know, it was always too simplistic to think that all you needed for higher education was a fairly light touch regulator with all the other things that we think we want it to do. You know, whether that's exploring housing demand in particular bits of the country or free speech, or, you know, requiring universities to help you level up the country or to act in going back to the kind of green revolution in that kind of forward-looking industrial strategy. So I think the essential problem we've got here is that it was the wrong model when we started with it. And we need to think rather more broadly about what does a proper model look like, and how do we get there, rather than how do we just kind of keep going through this piecemeal, quick, give it to the OFS and they'll whack up the fee and everything will be fine.
Chris, I mean, I still don't really, I don't really think, you know, from when you were there, I don't really get a sense that it's still clear what it is that DfE does and what it is that OFS does in relation to England's higher education. And, you know, even if you ignore the kind of UKRI question, particularly around PGR students, it seems to me that it's still not really clear what the respective responsibilities are. And that, you know, that's a recipe for chaos, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think probably what you saw was, obviously, you have this sequencing of ministers. You know, Joe Johnson sort of came in with a clear vision of what he wanted to do. He sold it to David Cameron. Yeah, there might have been a bit of overlap with Willett sort of working on this thing of trying to sort of understand how to raise standards, but at the same time as doing so in a accountability mechanism that recognizes sort of the, you know, value for money for the fee level and all this stuff. And then, you know, that was done very much on a perspective of almost a consumer protection, I guess, sort of thinking about the we had those debates around duty of care and what does that require. And then we shifted in, and, you know, I was an implementing minister. I sort of came in, and, you know, the challenge I would say is that I don't see anyone coming in and putting new primary legislation in. The thing is like OFS like is written into primary legislation, which makes it very difficult to basically unpick it. And I don't see Labour having that appetite. You know, they'll have other priorities to focus on if they become the next government. But then we had this challenge where, you know, Gavin Williamson and to an extent Michelle Donnellan came in, and, you know, they wanted to bring in a sort of culture war to focus on sort of social based issues, freedom of speech. And so the very sort of intention for setting up OFS, so that it went in a completely different direction, because the ministers had lost the power that they thought they had to be able to direct, you know, sort of the decision making processes, and all the power was in primary legislation for OFS. So that became the only instrument they could use. So I feel sorry for, and obviously OFS have gone through a number of personnel changes, not only at chief executive level, also at access and participation level as well. And, you know, that's not to say that those are, yeah, brilliant individuals, and I've got nothing against them. Yeah, as individuals, they're doing a great job, and, you know, on the personalities involved are passionate about making higher education work. But it's just this sort of sense of left hand, right hand, but also that sharp shift in policy intent from ministers about what's the purpose of the OFS that hasn't been resolved. You know, they're trying to cram in all this additional sort of culture, sort of war, sort of social based policy into the OFS when that wasn't its intention to start with.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to dig a bit deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out how we can keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Chris, Andy, Debbie, and news editor Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. Mark will be here next week. Until then, stay wonky.